explain what he's going to explain in a way that we can apply it and put it into practice and teach others. Thanks so much for this time. Tell us what you learned, and grow one more level each day. In Jesus' name, we pray.
Amen. Amen. Got a few coming in still. Thanks for coming. It's a little bit hard to find the place at first, but thanks to Jan for finding it. Jan spent hours and hours looking for a place to have this class. Pray that we get our mission center back soon, right? Anyway, this class is going to be a little bit different than some of the other classes we've done. We've done mainly Bible classes, which is a great thing, obviously. But this class is intended to help you grow in your faith in one very specific thing, which is that the Bible is inspired by God. Okay? And you hear a lot of junk. I mean, you hear a lot of junk. You wouldn't believe some of the questions I get at my website. And a lot of people obviously don't believe in the Bible, but believe stuff about the Bible that's really, I mean, utterly ridiculous. But the problem is, a lot of us, we hear that stuff and we kind of go, you know what I'm saying? I don't really know how to respond. So then the purpose of this class then is to help you to know how to respond. Now, there's different aspects of apologetics, because this is apologetics, okay? By the way, when I say apologetics, we're not saying, oh, we're sorry that we're a Christian. Apologetics means to explain. In other words, a Christian apologist is explaining reasons why the Bible is true, why Christianity is true as opposed to false or as opposed to other religions, okay? So, and the way I see it, there's two aspects of apologetics. One aspect of apologetics we can use to help people become a Christian, all right? For example, I had a study with a guy just last week. We're going to study with him again on Monday. And we just looked at the prophecies of the Messiah. And it was so cool because he came in there. He was kind of Eastern religion. He's kind of talking a little bit like New Age, Eastern religion, a little Buddhism, you know, Jesus, you know, all that sort of stuff. And we're going through these prophecies of the Messiah. And by the end of the study, he's going like, wow. You know, I had no idea. So things like prophecy, the miracles of Jesus, the resurrection. These are positive apologetics we can use to actually help people become a Christian. Just last weekend, I was in Milwaukee, and this guy came up to me and said, yeah, you know, I gave one of my books about science and God, gave it to my friend who's a total atheist. I said, look, I just want you to read the book. Just read the book. And he read the book, and he was baptized a few weeks later. But this class is not of that sort, all right? Because this is evidence to support our faith, all right, and to explain to the skeptics. But it's not like you can show somebody, look, here is the Rylands Papyrus, and they're going to, oh, I believe, and I'm going to become a Christian, all right? So the purpose of this class is not to give you evidence to show to people, and then they're going to turn themselves in as a sinner and become a Christian, all right? It's more to support your faith, okay? Got it? Now, I don't know if you care about the outline, but you're supposed to give an outline when you teach a class. So I'm going to give an outline. I guess I'm sort of in the way, aren't I? We didn't know what the setup was going to be here, so we got a TV. That's cool. It's TV. As if, you know, it's like being at home, I guess. Everybody can see it, right?
Yeah.
Except the one I'm standing in front of, which, yeah, I just moved. You were able to see. Now you can't see. All right. So first of all, I'm going to talk a little bit, advice about how to handle skeptics and how to handle questions that people throw out at you, okay? Just sort of generic advice there. And then we're going to talk about the documents that support the New Testament. And then we're going to talk about the canon of the New Testament, which does not mean you know, light it, boom, you know, fire it in the hole. It's C-A-N-O-N. The word canon comes from Cain. And Cain was like, that was the ruler. Okay, so the canon. In other words, people will say, how do you know such and such are in the Bible? I picked. So we'll talk a little bit about the canonization of the New Testament. All right, and then we'll talk about the manuscripts that support the Old Testament. We'll talk about the canonization, how the Old Testament came together in its final form. And then we'll spend some time looking at extra biblical documents. In other words, other documents that people said, well, you know, it's all confusing. This should have been in the Bible, but it isn't. And there's 47 different gospels, and somebody in the, you know, some Roman person chose it. I get this stuff at my website all the time. Trust me, believe me. So we're going to look at like the Apocrypha, and then we'll look at the scriptures of other religions. You know, one thing that kind of bugs me a little bit is that people often criticize the Bible, but they don't criticize other religions in the same way. It's interesting. For example, you know, Muslims will attack the Christian scriptures, and yet they won't even entertain questions about their own scriptures. All right, and so we'll even look at, you know, what would it mean to say that Buddhist scriptures or Hindu scriptures are inspired as opposed to the biblical scriptures. All right, and then we'll talk about the inspiration of the Bible. All right, and we're going to step back a little bit, and we're going to ask, I assume everybody here believes the Bible is inspired by God. Mm-hmm. All right, yeah. But we're going to ask questions like, well, what would that actually mean? All right, and then what are some of the reasons to believe that the Bible, in fact, might be inspired by God? And then a harder question is the question of inerrancy. All right, how many people in this room think the Bible has mistakes?
What do you call mistakes?
All right, we got two people here. Lauren and I thinks the Bible has mistakes. Yeah. Whoa. Okay. Now. All right. What do I mean by that? So. By the way, I believe the Bible is without error, as originally written by the authors. But when we defend biblical inerrancy, we're going to find out we have to think about that really, really carefully. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll also respond to the idea that the New Testament, how we can be confident of the age when it was written, that it was really written in the first century. We'll talk about things like that. And then we'll define and defend biblical inerrancy, and then we'll talk about supposed contradictions. I assume you've heard the Bible has so many contradictions, how you believe in it. We'll talk about that a little bit. And then we'll talk about some of the evidence internal to the Bible for its inspiration. We're not going to spend a lot of time there because that would be a whole other course. All right, so that's our outline. Any questions? Please interrupt me if you have any questions. Okay, moving along here. All right, so how do I deal with questions? All right? I see Christians making a fair number of mistakes in dealing with attacks on Christianity and questions about their faith. Now, the biggest mistake, of course, is not being prepared to answer, right? So 1 Peter 3:15, I don't even need to turn to this passage. Everybody in this room knows about this passage. But I think it's worth rereading and being challenged. Of course, I'm speaking to the choir here. In other words, the people who need to hear this verse are the ones who are not here, not the ones who are here, right? Because that's why you're here, is because you're in response to this passage. All right, so it says, verse 15, taking it somewhat out of context, to be honest with you. But in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. So the Bible is commanding us. God is commanding us to be prepared to answer. Now, that doesn't mean you need to, a week from now, be prepared to answer every single question that somebody would ask. And by the way, when in doubt, you just send them to me or to my website. There's 2,000 questions now that have been answered at my website, probably including the question that somebody's asking you. But it's definitely better to give your own answer, all right? It's definitely better because it just helps increase the person's confidence. It sort of increases your faith to see their life changing. When we give people the impression that we believe just because we believe, but for no particular reason, just because we believe, that doesn't help them to come to faith, obviously. So to some extent, then, it's our job. So my first advice on how to answer questions is know the answer, okay? And know as many of the answers as you can. And one thing I advise people to do is, I assume there's things about Christianity that you have doubts about. There has to be. If there aren't, then you're just not even thinking. Come on, give me a break. There's got to be things about Christianity you wonder about, or things that people have said and you found yourself saying, yeah, what about that? So my suggestion is to keep a running list of these questions. Literally write them down. All right? And what will happen is over the next 3, 6, maybe 9 months, maybe a year, the list will get longer. All right. One thing we've been doing the singles is we've been collecting prayers. They had this prayer book, and then we have a separate book for the prayers that got answered. We kind of move them over to the other book. You know what I'm saying? But what I'm saying is, with these doubts and questions about Christianity, I am convinced that if you're willing to do a little research, what will happen is within either 3 months or 6 months or a year, your list will start to get shorter, not longer. All right? And then you'll see this checklist of all these questions that you had that got answered. That's really going to build up your faith, but it's also going to prepare you to answer. And it also says to do it with gentleness and respect. That's one of the things I've seen. Is unfortunately, it's sad but true, I've seen Christians behave in a worldly way as they answer people's questions by demeaning them, by cutting down their religion, by implying they're stupid, or you know, being sarcastic. And these are kinds of behavior that we should never, ever use. Our weapons are not the weapons of the world, right? So we watch the current election cycle, and we're learning everything we will never, ever do, right? Amen. Amen. Not tweeting at 3 o'clock in the morning disrespectful things about public figures. But anyway, I'm not going to go there. All right. So it says to do it with gentleness and respect. Okay. Next, don't paint yourself into a corner. Don't overreach. Don't oversell your evidence. This happens often. It really bothers me when atheists or non-believers make claims that are unsubstantiated, that are partially true but highly exaggerated. But unfortunately, Christians are absolutely guilty of this. I've seen it again and again and again. So I'd say, always, when in doubt, present a conservative version of what you understand to be true. Don't say the New Testament is 99.9% accurate just because you read it somewhere. All right, give a number that is actually conservative. All right, that's how you'd want somebody to treat you. You would not want somebody to manipulate the evidence. You would not want somebody to show part of the evidence and sort of willfully hold back some of the evidence. You wouldn't want somebody to do that to you. So don't paint yourself into a corner. Don't make claims that really you can't actually back up. You know, don't say things like history proves the Bible. That's way overselling. We're going to do a whole conference about history and archaeology in the Bible in November, and I believe history supports the Bible in amazing ways. But to say that history proves the Bible, that's a little strong. All right, but on the other hand, don't undersell it either. You know, people, make all kinds of statements about the Bible, and I think we need to counter those things. We need to not just let them say these bogus things. So I'll just give an example. We're going to talk about quoting from the church fathers, the early church writers, and people will say things like, oh, but they just paraphrased, and they'll say stuff like, Paul, when he was quoting the Old Testament, paraphrased the Bible, proving the Bible's not reliable. And, you know, we can't let people say something like that without responding to that. So, again, I would say when people say wrong things, say something. Point it out. One of my favorite stories, I've told this before, is I was in a van with a bunch of science professors, and this one lady said, Christianity, what a stupid religion, you know. I can't believe it. And, of course, she's assuming, because we're all science professors, obviously all scientists agree with her that Christianity is stupid. She's assuming that. And then she said, yeah, for example, in the Old Testament it says that if you wear clothing with more than one material, like cotton and wool or something like that, you go to hell. Oh, no, sorry, capital punishment. So anyway, I spoke up, obviously. You know, we need to say something. So I said, no, it doesn't say that. I'm telling you, it doesn't say that. She said, oh, yes, it does. I found it at a website. Well, there you go. That's you know, so these people, they haven't even read the Bible. They say stuff like, you know, the New Testament was created by all these other myths and all that kind of stuff. They took the Persian myths and the Greek myths. And this is ignorant stuff, folks. We can't let people say it. So on the other hand, don't oversell your case, but don't undersell it. All right? When people make statements that are flat out untrue, you need to say something. Now, to get back to my story, I said to them, you know, I've read the Bible through, I don't know, half a dozen times anyway. As far as I know, there are no science errors in the Bible. Everybody says there are. And then I had to find that verse, the one in Leviticus, about clothing made out of two materials. All right, could you find that one? The Bible says, always be prepared to give an answer. So you got to be able to find verses like that. Now, luckily, I knew it was on the right-hand side of the page, somewhere in Leviticus, because it was my old Bible. I don't want to oversell my case either, that I know everything in the Bible. But, you know, we need to know what we're talking about. But I say we also need to speak up. Another thing is...
So what happened? Was it in there?
It's in there. It doesn't say anything about capital punishment. It does prohibit it. It says don't do it. It might even say... I think it just says don't do it. It just says don't do it. And it may even say, you know, the consequences. But either way, it's not capital punishment. That's not true. Anyway, but you can imagine when I actually pulled out my Bible. You can imagine when I pulled out my Bible in that setting, it got really quiet. You know? Yeah. Another thing is leave some ammunition in your gun. All right. Now, that might be a bad analogy, especially given what went on this week in El Cajon and stuff. It's kind of a sad situation. But what I mean by that is hold back some of your evidence. Hold back some of your arguments. All right? That's really important. Because, you know, people will say, it'll come back with such and such, and then you have some more things to say. So I'd say, you know, use your evidence, but hold back some of it. All right? So that when people say things, you have more to say. Don't be intimidated. You know what? You have an advantage. When you're discussing things like the inspiration of the Bible, whether Christianity is true, you know what one of the big advantages you have is? You're right. You happen to be right. And they happen to be wrong. So, for example, if you assume that they're saying it's a contradiction, if you assume that it's, in fact, not a contradiction, you're right. Now, you're not allowed to assume that you're right in a conversation. Don't ever do that. Don't use circular reasoning. Don't use 2 Timothy 3:16 to prove the Bible's inspired by God. You don't do that, all right? That's the one that says the Bible's inspired by God. But that's not evidence, right? That is not evidence the Bible's inspired by God, all right? So what was I saying? I forgot. Yeah. Don't be intimidated. These people are wrong. You know, sometimes you have an argument with somebody. Jan and I'll have a discussion, and we settle it by Google. That's how we settle almost all of our discussions. But you know, when I say something, I like to say, but I don't always, that I might be wrong. You know what I'm saying? But when we're talking about the inspiration of the Bible. When we're talking about the perfection of the Bible and the fact that it is the truth, it is from God. You know, it's kind of nice to know in your heart that you're right. It's kind of like in the football game tonight, if you knew that you were going to win, if you were a prophet, you know, they'd say some stuff, and you're like, yeah, whatever, buddy, you know, because you knew you're going to win. Well, it's kind of like that with the Bible. All right. Yeah.
It's interesting you talked about the fabric with two different materials. I was sitting down one time with a sophisticated, learned Jewish lady at an athletic banquet for the kids. Anyway, I was kind of curious about this one, you know.
Which one?
The mix wool and cotton.
All right, yeah, okay.
That's pretty common today, especially cotton poly. But anyway, I go, why is that in there? And I expected her to say, well, you know, the dietary rules make sense, whether a fabric or not. And I thought she was going to come up with that, something like that, you know. And she goes, I don't need logic. God said it. That's enough.
Wow, okay.
I thought that was
By the way, I believe it's about not mixing with other peoples. There's many, many rules in the Old Testament, and the purpose of them is to give a message to be righteous, that you're different, you don't mix with other peoples. Yeah, I'm guessing that I really appreciate that woman's faith, but I'm guessing the rabbi would not say that. They would just whip out that answer right away.
Well, yeah, I've been reading your Shadows to Reality book, and maybe it's like some kind of foreshadowing of not being yoked with the world.
Well, yeah, well, in the sense that the teaching is the same, yes, that the teaching is the same. Right. What he's saying is, in the New Testament, it kind of looks back to the Old Testament, and it's saying, come out and be separate from them and be holy. And then these kinds of things are physical representations of the spiritual teaching we have in the New Testament, which is that we're not to be part of the world. We're in the world, but not of it.
It's Leviticus 19:19.
There you go. Leviticus 19:19. Now, I couldn't have told you that, but I did know it was on the right-hand side about halfway down. That's lucky for me. By the way, prayer always helps. You have the Holy Spirit in you, right? Jesus even said to the apostles, you're going to know stuff to say that the Holy Spirit's going to tell you what to say. So a little quick prayer when somebody asks you a question, it never hurts. All right. Now, I want to talk about some of the criticisms that are sort of thrown out there about the New Testament. Now, hopefully you already heard about these criticisms. The last thing I want to do is have you go away, wow, I never thought about that. Yeah, maybe the Bible isn't true. The last thing I want to have happen is that, all right? But I'm telling you, at some point, you're going to hear these things. I guarantee you. Either that or you're sticking your head in a hole. Either that or you're not sharing your faith, so nobody bothers to try to convince you out of it. Something like that. All right? So a common statements that are out there is the Gospels written in the second century are fabrications designed to make Jesus into some sort of God, which he himself never claimed to be. Well, you're definitely going to hear that one. That either they were written in the second century, or they were dramatically changed in the second century to represent a theology that they'd made up, which was not part of what Jesus taught. Oh, trust me, folks, you're going to hear that a lot. Another thing you're going to hear is that there were dozens of Gospels in existence in the 2nd and 3rd century, and that in the early church there was really no consensus about which were the correct Gospels. Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Judas, Gospel of Mary, all these other things. And what they'll say is everybody knows that the victors, you know, get to write history, you know what I'm saying? So in the 4th century, the church made these decisions of the Council of Nicaea, and they buried all the other things and all of the records of these other groups that said these things. They burned them and all this kind of stuff. By the way, this is a bunch of garbage. I mean, it is absolute garbage. I'm telling you. But the question is, what's the kind of information we can use to show that this doesn't make any sense? Bart Ehrman, he's kind of the total enemy of Christianity. He's the most well-known. And, by the way, he's a great scholar. Bart Ehrman is a great scholar. He's pretty amazing, actually. But he's one of these guys that will write intelligent garbage. I'm. Don't say that. Don't quote me on that. Because remember, he said, "Do it with gentleness and respect." And you know, I just called one of the greatest scholars, a New Testament scholar, garbage. So do not quote me on. It's on the tape. But anyway, setting a bad example. Don't do what I just did. Do what I say you should do rather than what I just did. But he's written books like The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, and he's trying to imply that there was wholesale changing of the New Testament, and that according to certain theological perspectives, and therefore, what Jesus actually said, and the actual teachings of the apostles are obscured by these kind of things. So we're going to have responses to these different claims, all right? One thing in the notes, I'm publishing the notes. In the notes, I've got a few questions. I'm not going to go over them now. But in the notes, I just sprinkled in just, you know, three or four questions that came to my website, typical kinds of questions. I'm not going to respond to these in detail, but just to give you a feeling. So please clear up for me a doubt about the difference between the scriptures. The scriptures are Genesis 46:27, which says there are 70 members that went with Jacob to Egypt, and Acts 7:14, which says there are 75 members of the family that went with Jacob to Egypt. Well, was it 75 or 70?
75.
All right, so how do you respond to that? Well, look up in my notes. I got about a page and a half response to that, okay? All right, I'm purposely not going to even answer that question, and unless you ask me, I'll if you want me to. All right, here's another one. Is it true that Ezra was the individual who put together the Old Testament canon? I've heard from my Blasphemy 101 class, in other words, religion class at college, that he changed the Old Testament stories to seem more spiritual. For example, the story of David and the destruction and fall of the first temple due to sin were changed by Ezra. I was somewhat bothered by this, so I went online to do some research, and all I could find about the biblical canon was on Wikipedia, and he goes on. And so this is a question about the canonization of the Old Testament and the claim that Ezra somehow wholesale changed the Old Testament. Okay, these are kind of things that come out that hopefully at the end of this class you'll be able to have an intelligent response to. A page and a half to answer that one. Here we go. Here's another one. I've read time and again that the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and John, why they didn't list Luke, I don't know, were passed down by oral tradition. How do we know that the oral tradition passed down is authentic in eyewitness accounts? By the way, this is actually true. Apparently, the first gospel was written for at least, let's say, about 15 years after Jesus. And so there was an oral tradition, and people are passing that along. So how do we know that oral tradition didn't change over time? All right, that's a pretty good question. All right, enough of that. I need to actually get into the material for the class, so let's start the class. Yeah, a question. Actually, I'm going to throw out a couple of examples of criticisms before I go into the New Testament evidence. Have you heard about the Gospel of Judas? That was discovered about maybe 8 years or so ago. And this is one of these, I would call it an apocryphal gospel or a competitor possibly. And when this thing, it's an actual document. It was found in Egypt. You can see that it's not in the most amazing condition, but they can reconstruct the text of the Gospel of Judas. And by the way, it's in Coptic. It's not in Greek. It's in Coptic. In fact, it's a translation of the original Gospel of Judas. Okay. Okay, the National Geographic published an article about the Gospel of Judas. These are a couple of quotes. Some of these alternative versions, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Judas, may have circulated more widely than the familiar four Gospels. All right? Well, what about that?
If that was true, then why don't we have them
now? All right. Yeah, because we just have one manuscript of the Gospel of Judas, and we have thousands of manuscripts in the New Testament, which sort of belies that claim. All right. Another response that I could give is, well, that's interesting because Ignatius and Polycarp and Irenaeus and Tertullian, all these church fathers quoted the New Testament so extensively that you could reproduce the entire New Testament virtually just from their quotes. The only one of them ever even mentioned the Gospel of Judas is Irenaeus, in which he debunks the book as being a late second century forgery of no value, and then he goes on. The National Geographic just throws that out there as if this was believable. And it's beyond belief. It is ridiculously unbelievable to the point that these people claim to be scholars, and they make an totally ignorant statement. But the thing is, we have to deal with stuff because people accept this as if it was the truth. And they said a long buried side of Christianity is reemerging. Well, to some extent, that's slightly true, actually, because the Gospel of Judas does give us evidence about the teachings of one heretical group. By the way, it was quoted extensively when Irenaeus refuted it. It's not like we didn't know about the Gospel of Judas. Irenaeus wrote a book against the heretics, Contra a Heretic or whatever, in which he quoted it from extensively. So it's not like it was completely hidden, but you know, this is slightly tiny bit true, I guess. All right. In fact, it is unclear whether the authors of any of the Gospels, even the familiar four, actually witnessed the events they described. All right. Oh, man, I'm telling you. That burns me. That really burns me. By the way, it is an actual manuscript. It was discovered in the 70s, but it lay in a drawer for about 30 years because people didn't realize it was an important manuscript. And it does come from the late 3rd century. All right. It's a Coptic manuscript. Like I said, Irenaeus quoted it in his book Against Heresies. It probably was written somewhere between 150 and 170 A.D. And it's real, by the way. It's real. But there's a few things about it that are, yeah.
Is carbon dating, has it been proven to be actually reliable?
Yeah, very reliable. There you go, 220 to 340. That's a broader than usual range. That's a range of about 80 years, plus or minus 40. I'm sorry, plus or minus 120. Yeah, the reason we can do that is, for example, you can go to Pompeii and you can take, say, a papyrus found in the city of Pompeii. You know when the city got burned down, and you can measure its age. Now, that's not the best example, because when things get burned, that does slightly affect the carbon-14 ratio. But there's sufficient, let's say, 2% of all finds you can give a definite date to. Let's just say, just to throw it out there. Let's just say there's 2% you could actually give a definite date to for other reasons. And they do carbon-14 dating, and carbon-14 dating is good to plus or minus 40 years or 60, depending on the quantity of carbon in the sample.
What about the age of the Earth and rocks?
It's irrelevant to the age of the Earth. The reason is the half-life of carbon-14 is 5,700 years. So anything older than about 25,000 years, you can't even use carbon-14 to measure its age. So people say carbon-14 dating is unreliable. First of all, I mean, that's about as true as that as this statement here. I mean, this statement is slightly true, and carbon-14 dating is unreliable is slightly true, as in it has uncertainty. So a person gives the range 220 to 340. And scientists, by the way, are in these, they've been trained to do what I'm asking us to do with our evidence, which is to present a conservative case. So whoever quoted this number probably could have used a narrower range if they'd wanted to. Probably. I'm not positive about that. But it's quite reliable. For example, the Shroud of Turin comes from the early 14th century A.D. I mean, that's when it was made, you know, and it's reliable. But as for the age of the Earth, carbon-14 is irrelevant because, like I said, it's only good to about 25,000 years. Now, there's other radioisotope dating methods other than carbon-14 that can be used. And there's a couple of reasons why carbon-14 dating has a certain kind of uncertainties, because it depends on the amount of carbon-14 in the air. It varies slightly over time. And so they have to even make little corrections. For example, if you use the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere today to date something, let's say from 1540 BC, it would be off by 4 or 5%. But the reason they know that is they have actual samples from that date. And they can see, oh, it's off by about 4 or 5%. Anyway, I'm giving you more detail than you probably wanted. Uranium lead dating and potassium argon dating are used for things that are hundreds of millions of years old. And they're, you know, approximately as reliable as carbon-14 dating. Okay? All right. Anyway, about the Gospel of Judas, it's real. And these are some quotes from the Gospel of Judas. And by the way, as far as this having any relevance to what Jesus actually said or did, It has none. It has none at all. It's totally, completely, utterly fake. What's interesting, even the Gnostics don't quote the Gospel of Judas. That's the funny thing. When they're not, because we can read writings by the people that produce this garbage, and I can call this garbage. I can say that because I'm not offending any living person. The Gospel of Judas, because even the Gnostics never quoted the Gospel of Judas. Even the Gnostics never quoted the Gospel of Thomas. Even they only quoted the four canonical Gospels. So there you go. All right. But anyway, the secret account of the revelation that Jesus spoke in conversation with Judas Iscariot. According to this gospel, which, by the way, is not a gospel because it doesn't include the birth of Jesus. It doesn't have any miracles of Jesus. It doesn't have the death of Jesus or the resurrection of Jesus. So it's not a gospel by any definition of the word gospel, which would be a story of Jesus, essentially. But anyway, in this gospel, Judas is actually the closest disciple to Jesus. All right? And then Jesus revealed these secret, deep teachings to Judas. And then Judas wrote them down. Now, what's the obvious problem with that? He died, you know? He died. I mean, what are you talking about? You know, this is really ridiculous. So Jesus reveals secret, deep knowledge of his purpose. And I'm telling you, the person who wrote this didn't believe it. All right? And the people who read the Gospel of Judas knew that it was a pseudo story. It was intended to kind of, you know, teach something. But even the people who read the Gospel of Judas knew it wasn't real. And yet these scholars try to, you know, create the impression it might be an alternative actual story about Jesus. Look at this quote. "Come that I may teach you about the secrets no person has seen." And in this gospel, there are 12 aeons, which are one level of gods, and there's 72 heavens and 72 luminaries and 360 firmaments and 360 luminaries, five for each of these. In this gospel, you have Nebro, Yaldabaoth, Saklas, Galilo. These are these different emanations of God. And by the way, in this gospel, Christ is also known as Seth, and he's one of the seven emanations of God. And, you know, come on. And if you read Gnostic writings, and there were non-Christian Gnostics, so these people didn't claim Christianity at all, and they have the same stuff in there. So it's pretty obvious what's going on here. Okay. The key comes near the end where Jesus says, "For you will sacrifice the man that clothes me." That's Gnosticism. In other words, the Gnostics believed that Jesus was entirely spiritual, and he simply occupied this body, but the body was not Jesus, that he was entirely spiritual, because they believed that physical things are evil. Anyway, I'm not getting into Gnosticism. All right, and then, I'll talk a little bit about these other Gospels. The Da Vinci Code, that's a kind of an old example. I mean, most of the crowd here is under 22, I think. About half. So the Da Vinci Code, you don't even remember that. But us old folks, I don't know why I'm picking you out there, but us old folks, I mean, even David probably saw the Da Vinci Code. He's old enough. Read the book, okay. So, by the way, this stuff was accepted as gospel. There's a little play on words there. Accepted as gospel, ha, 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 ha. The Da Vinci Code. Almost everything our fathers taught us about Christ is false. All right, Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world. In other words, Constantine in the 4th century made Jesus to be deity. All right, it was all about power. The early church literally stole Jesus from his original followers, hijacking his human message, shrouding it in an impenetrable cloak of divinity, and using to expand their own power. By the way, I'm not going to show you the evidence, but by the time we're done today, you're going to realize how incredibly crazy this is. Yeah.
It's written by David Brown, right?
Yeah, Dan Brown. Dan Brown.
Yeah, the good thing about it is it made me think, well, what's the Bible really say?
Yeah, right. Read the book, and then it'll force you to actually look at the evidence, which we're going to give you today.
So he talks
All right, and so this is a character in the book. My dear, Teabing declared, until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man. By the way, were there people in the first century that believed that Jesus was a mere man?
Yeah.
There were, just so you know. All right, but this guy wants to blow that up into creating the impression that the church as a whole actually believed that, which is completely utterly unsupportable by any evidence, et cetera. More than 80 Gospels were considered. Look at that. More than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament. That is a sheer, utter lie. But people quote it all the time. Anyway, let's get to the evidence, because I have to take a break in about 10 minutes. So I better get at least some evidence in there. Okay, great. So let's talk about it. We're going to have different words. We're going to use manuscript. A manuscript is any ancient document which contains all or parts of the New or Old Testament. The word literally means handwritten. That's why they call it manuscript. Okay, canon. The canon, which comes from the Greek word reed or cane or measuring stick, it basically is the accepted list of New and Old Testament books. We're going to find out that there's some questions not about the New Testament canon, but there are significant questions about the Old Testament canon, and what does that say about the reliability, inerrancy, and inspiration of the scriptures. That's going to be an important point. Scrolls. The Jews had their scrolls, okay? A long piece of written material. By the way, probably the reason Luke and Acts is two separate books is that it didn't fit on one scroll. And Isaiah needed two scrolls. It's too long for one scroll. All right, and so there were standard length scrolls that they would make on generally on vellum, and vellum is basically treated sheepskin. Parchment is treated calf skin. Now the most famous manuscripts are actually papyrus. And most of the early New Testament manuscripts were on papyrus, but luckily for us, there was this political fight between the Greeks and the Egyptians, and then the papyrus kind of, became rare. Luckily for us, because papyrus doesn't last very long, but vellum and parchment. By the way, you can read where Paul writes to Timothy, bring the parchments or something like that. So you can see that he was writing things down on parchment. All right, codex. Basically, a codex was like a book. So what they would take is a long piece of papyrus, and they'd fold it, like kind of like an accordion. They didn't have books like we have, where you have a binding on the back, and then pages glued into the binding. They didn't have that. They had codices. So codex, and the most important New Testament manuscripts are codexes. All right, I think codices is the plural of codex. Probably, I don't really know. I'm pretty sure. So these things are essentially long strips of papyrus folded like this. So we'll hear about codex A and palimpsest B and all these kinds of things. Okay, papyrus. Obviously, that was the common writing material. We don't have a lot of papyrus manuscripts. We're going to see a few of them today, simply because papyrus just doesn't last very long. All right, aren't you glad that it doesn't last very long? Because the things you wrote down there, not going to see it. Okay, good. Vellum or parchment. All right, this was much more easily preserved. Vellum is made from sheepskin. Parchment is made from goat or calf or antelope skins, and there was a whole science of making these things to make them soft and write-onable. The backside they didn't write on because that's the side that had the hair on there, and that would they scrape it off and all this sort of stuff. Uncial, all right. These are texts that are all capital letters. It turns out, in the first and second century and into the third century. When they wrote Greek, they did only capital letters. Okay, and so if you see a manuscript, we'll show you some. I might ask you, is this a relatively old one or a younger one? All right, and so the uncials, these are the oldest manuscripts. All of our oldest manuscripts have all capital letters. And to make it worse for copying, all capital letters with no spaces between them. And if it ended in the middle of a word at the end of a line, they would just go to the next line, even though it's in the middle of the word, and they didn't use dashes. So that leads to problems of copying the New Testament, as we'll see. And then cursive or minuscule, that would be the writing we're used to with the capitals and then small letters. These came into use much later. So the cursive or minuscule manuscripts are of very little value in discovering what the original New Testament was, although it might have some value. So on the left is an uncial manuscript. On the right is minuscule. I'll get off to the side better. Okay, in fact, what I can do is this. And here's a papyrus manuscript on the left and a vellum codex on the right. Now, this codex was not... Some codexes were in the form more like our typical book. This one here is... It looks like a book. So this one had the pages sort of glued into some back. But a lot of the papyrus codices were like... Remember the Gospel of Judas? You could see the different layers. The Gospel of Judas was one of these folded things, not a book. Okay, at least that particular manuscript. Okay, got it? Now let's talk about the manuscript evidence for the New Testament. And I'll just tell you, it's insane how much evidence we have. Not only do we have more manuscripts of the New and Old Testament than any other ancient book, we have more manuscripts of the Old and the New Testament than of all other ancient books combined, at least from that part of the world. So we have a ridiculous amount of evidence. And when I talk about Islam, you're going to find out that there's almost no manuscript evidence from the Quran, because Uthman, one of the early caliphs, had them all burned, because he's trying to get rid of the evidence, all right, and trying to cover it up. All right, and so just as a comparison, these are some well-known books. I'm sure they're super well-known. Sophocles, I'm sure. Anybody here ever read Sophocles? I never have, okay. Oh, okay, you've read Sophocles? Good. All right, you must have gone to a Christian in high school or something like that, no? Oh, really? You're reading it in a secular high school, very interesting. But anyway... So we have, for example, the greatest historians of the ancient world are Herodotus, Thucydides, and we have 8 manuscripts of Herodotus. We do not have anywhere near a complete copy of the writings of Herodotus, only 8 partial ones. And the oldest manuscript we have from Herodotus comes from 1,350 years after it was written. So that's a long time. And, you know, and by the time you have this manuscript of Herodotus, it's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. And how many times, I don't really know. Because how long would these things last? All right. What about Aristotle's writings? Everybody believes that Aristotle wrote what we have from Aristotle. Nobody questions this. Aristotle's book Physics, which is the greatest book in the ancient world on natural philosophy. And we read Aristotle's writings, and we assume it's what he wrote, right? Why not? You know? But then, when they have a New Testament manuscript where we have 1,000 times as many things for much closer, they question whether he wrote it. It's interesting. They question whether, in that National Geographic article, they question whether the eyewitnesses wrote them. Do they question whether Julius Caesar wrote Julius Caesar's things? Do they question whether Thucydides wrote Thucydides' things? Nobody ever questions any of this stuff. Why not? Because Satan has got a whole thing going here, I think. But it is irrational. The way the Bible is treated is literally irrational. All right? And we could go on and on. In the case of the Old Testament, we have 5,000 manuscripts. Now, that's manuscripts in the original language. That's not counting translations. In the case of the New Testament, we have 8,000 Greek manuscripts. And all of these, there was over 1,000 years between when they were written and the oldest manuscript, with one exception being Homer. We have one copy of Homer from about 100 AD, so we're lucky there. All right? And the oldest manuscripts of the New Testament are within 50 years of when it was written. In fact, we could actually lower it down to 25 now with some new evidence. All right? So the evidence supporting the believability, the reliability of the text of the New Testament is amazing.
What was the original language, John, in the Old Testament?
Hebrew. There's Aramaic in the books of Ezra and Daniel. All right. In Daniel chapter 2, he says, and Nebuchadnezzar said in Aramaic, that in Aramaic is in Hebrew, and the next word is Aramaic. So, correct. So it is ironic, I think, that people totally undermine and question the reliability of the document, which is by far, there is not even any comparison whatsoever, the one we have by far the most reliable sources for. All right, I'm going to go just 5 more minutes because we need to take our break. I already went too long. I should have taken a break already. But I have to give you at least a couple of minutes. I can't help it. So here's the Rylands Papyrus. It's John 18, 31 through 33, and then 37. Well, you ask, what happened to 34, 35, 36? Well, this one's written on both sides. Papyruses were written on both sides. All right, and so on the back side, and this is been dated to 125 A.D., folks. And so I don't know when the book Gospel of John was written. I believe it's in the 70s. Most of the critics say in the 80s or 90s, but they tend to give the later date. So the bottom line is we have a copy of John from less than 50 years from when it was written. And I've been to the Rylands Papyrus. It's there in Manchester. It's pretty cool to go to. You can see it. How about this is a gospel from the Sackler Library, which is in Rome. And it's not very attractive looking, but there you go. It's a copy of John 18:36 through 19:1 from 150 AD. All right? Now, these are not complete New Testaments. The bottom line is most of the early copies of the New Testament, unfortunately, were in papyrus. And the fact that we have any copies at all is actually quite fortunate. But one of the reasons is because there were thousands and thousands of copies of these things. Okay, here's the Magdalene manuscript of Matthew. Now, some people have tried to say it comes from 90 AD. But I'd much prefer to use the conservative date. There's arguments for 90 AD, and people have written treatises on this. I'm gonna always go for the conservative date. So if you see something that I'm quoting, you can probably assume that I'm not sort of pushing my luck here. When the Magdalene manuscript came out and people were trying to say 80 or 90 AD, I refused to publish an article about that on my website because I don't think we should be writing stuff that's not for sure. But 175 AD, folks, that's pretty impressive. I got to go to the Chester Beatty Museum. It's in Dublin, and it's like a kid in a candy shop. It's the best collection of second and third century manuscripts in the world. There's a room filled with these things, filled with them from the second and third century. But here's 2 Corinthians 11, 33 through 12:9 from 200 AD. All right, now people say that Constantine changed the New Testament. So he would have to find this one and change it, and kind of erase it. Anyway, let's take a break.
John,
have some muffins.
Did scribes become irrelevant as the quality of the paper or of the material got better?
In other words, because the copies lasted longer? I don't know how to answer that question. Papyrus doesn't last.
Right.
But once you had vellum, I mean, I would say you'd have less need to constantly make new copies once you have vellum. I would say that's true.
John, did you see you went to the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, that was fun.
The first time they came,
see that exhibit they had where they still make papyrus? And I think.
Okay, the tape got started. Any more questions? Any more questions? Don't hesitate. You already aren't hesitating, which I appreciate. Don't hesitate to ask questions as they come up. By the way, a comment on these numbers. You have to admit the ratio of the number of New Testament manuscripts to the other ones is quite impressive. All right, but it's not just the number that creates the case for the reliability of the New Testament. It's the quality. It's the quality. And the closeness to the original date. For Tacitus, the greatest Roman historian, he wrote 14 histories, and we only have 4.5 of those 14, and only 2 Latin manuscripts. And yet, we believe Tacitus. All right, for Caesar, who wrote the Gallic Wars, Omnia Gallia est divisa in tres partes, right? And the oldest Latin manuscript is from almost 900 years later, and there's only 10 manuscripts of Julius Caesar. But again, it's not the fact that we have 8,000 manuscripts. It's the number of manuscripts we have that are very, very close in time span to the original. So if you're going to propose that changes were made, it kind of puts some constraints on that. By the way, back in the 1800s, critics used to say the entire New Testament was written in the second century. Even those people don't say that anymore. I mean, you can't be serious about that. All right, yeah. So anyway, there's all this technical stuff about papyri, and there's P1 and Aleph and all this sort of stuff. All the letters for the manuscripts. I'm going to just blow off all those details. If you look at the notes, I'm posting my notes. I give a little bit more information. It'd kind of be information overload. I don't think if you care that much about Codex A versus Codex B and all that kind of stuff. But they're named. Codices have capital letters, and papyruses have P's and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, whatever. I don't think you care about that so much. So we have the Rylands Papyrus, the John manuscript from 150, the Magdalene manuscript from 175. That's in the Magdalene Library in Oxford. Okay, and the Chester Beatty Papyri, which are they're mostly in the very, very late 2nd century and in the 3rd century. There's dozens of those. A number of the Chester Beatty Papyri, by the way, are in Ann Arbor, Michigan. There's a large collection of them there as well. The Bodmer Papyri, which are found in the Bodmer Library in Rome, discovered in 1952 in Egypt by Martin Bodmer. The one that you see here is a manuscript of John from 200 AD, and it has the entire book of John. By the way, it does not include John 7:53 through 8:11. Okay? We'll talk about that later. All right, we'll talk about things that are in our New Testaments that probably were not in the original, and that would probably include John 7:53 through 8:11. Okay? So the fact that the Bodmer manuscript of John from the end of the 2nd century does not include this passage about the woman caught in adultery is one of the pieces of evidence that makes it seem like that might have been a later addition. Okay, now we have a bunch of other things. We have like an abundance of evidence. Now, just 2 years ago, evidence was published from mummies. Now, they made mummy masks out of paper mache. You know what paper mache is? All right, like a pinata. And somebody thought, why not actually destroy these masks and see what's on there? And you can see why that most people wouldn't want to do that, because this one has not been destroyed. This is just a sample. This is not the one from which the mark fragments came, I assume anyway. But I'm guessing that thing's worth several thousand dollars, I'm guessing. All right, but some scholars decided to take, I assume anyway, some lesser quality samples of burial masks and look at the paper. And sure enough, they found fragments of Mark. And it's been dated to 80 plus or minus 20 AD. You got that, folks? Well, it was made out of all kinds of stuff. Paper mache is made out of paper, right? So paper you're willing to throw out. And so what that means is that you have a manuscript of Mark from the first century that was old enough, it was being thrown out. So I don't know how old it was at the time, all right, but presumably it wasn't brand new. Either way, when they do the carbon-14, the date is the date it would have been written, not the day it was thrown out. But that's pretty cool. So people who are trying to say that these things are in the second century, the bottom line is it pushes Mark into probably the middle of the first century. Now, that was discovered in... Right. That's you're making one of the points that I was supposed to make. I forgot to make. Right. It's evidence that because if this had been the only copy of one of only 10 copies, presumably there were hundreds of copies of Mark already in the first century. Otherwise, why would somebody be making paper mache out of it? And clearly it was somebody either a Christian or knew of Christianity. Obviously, otherwise they wouldn't have had it. And so... Right, the great point. It shows not only that Mark had been written, but that it was almost certainly considered inspired. It was being passed around as a gospel, and presumably there were hundreds, probably even thousands of copies already in the first century. And when you compare that to these apocryphal gospels, the stuff in Da Vinci Code becomes absolutely ludicrous. It's just totally ludicrous. All right, so this should increase your confidence. All right, that's pretty cool, actually. Now, by the way, a little caution here. This is a preliminary paper. They've not published their full findings. The date was based on carbon-14 and also stylistic things. But this one here, I would say not fully verified. It's the only manuscript I put up here that I'd have to say probably should be a little bit cautious of saying for sure, for sure, for sure. But I say compared to the Magdalene manuscript, when people said it was around 80 AD, when I was like, I don't trust that at all. I'm confident enough, at least put it up on the screen here, and I think it's probably going to hold up. But be a little bit cautious. You might want to tell your people it's been proved absolutely that a manuscript was marked from 80 AD. Maybe a little bit cautious there. There's the Codex Sinaiticus. Now we're talking about entire New Testaments. By the way, I was in the British Museum taking this picture when the person pointed out I'm not supposed to be taking pictures. Oops. No. It wasn't a flash, but that was kind of... Luckily, it didn't kick me out. It's sort of cool. If you go to the British... Not the British Museum, the British Library, and they have Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus, two of the three most important manuscripts of the Bible, on the same table. I mean, it's amazing. Anyway, so what we have is entire Bibles in Greek from 350 AD, not just entire New Testaments. Now, obviously, the Greek Old Testament is not necessarily, relevant to the Hebrew text, although it's evidence of the Greek translation of the Hebrew text in 300 AD, and we're going to see until the 1940s, our oldest Hebrew manuscripts were significantly after this date. So up until the 1940s, this would even have been strong evidence for the Old Testament, but we have the entire New Testament, the entire thing. From 350 A.D. That's Sinaiticus. There's a great story because there was a scholar who was at the monastery on Mount Sinai, and he found this in the trash, literally in the trash, and it was going to be taken out to be burned. This is in the early 20th century, I believe, and he pulled it out. It's like, OMG, you know? Wow. Pretty amazing. A Codex Vaticanus, I guess I don't have that one here. Codex Vaticanus from somewhere between 300 and 350 AD. The reason it's called Codex Vaticanus is because it's in the Vatican. All right, and so again, very early 4th century, roughly the time that of the Council of Nicaea, when supposedly the New Testament was changed. Well, we have the whole New Testament, a copy of it, from the same time. So they would have to go back and kind of do all these erasing. All right, these ideas are crazy. By the way, Codex Vaticanus technically is not the entire New Testament. It has nearly the entire Greek New and Old Testament with a partial omission of Hebrews. 1 and 2 Timothy is not in there for some reason. Titus, Philemon, Revelation, a little bit of Genesis, and some of Psalms. So a few pages are missing. In other words, I believe it's in a thing that looks like a book, but I believe it was rebound in that form. So there were a few pages that were missing from the Codex Vaticanus. The Sinaiticus was found by Tischendorf in 1844. I said early 20th century. I was wrong. 1844, found on Mount Sinai. It had an interesting history. The Tsar of Russia owned it for a while. The British Library owns it now. All right. And then Codex Alexandrinus, which was found in Alexandria. That's from late 4th century, almost 400 AD. It's of the Alexandrian text type. I'll talk about that in a bit. And I'll talk about these manuscripts have differences that are noticeable. And I'll talk about how we deal with that. So the Codex Alexandrinus, those are the big three. If you're taking notes, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus. These are all 4th century manuscripts of the entire New Testament. One of them is virtually the entire. The other two are the entire New Testament. Now we have by the way, I didn't mention the Washington Codex. There's hundreds of manuscripts, literally hundreds of manuscripts from before these. Not thousands, by the way. In fact, I probably should be careful. Probably it's more like around, not hundreds, but around 100. Around 100 or 200 from before 300 AD. Yeah. During the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries. And by the way, they did. They did. And we know that they did, actually. And he's a good scholar. He's careful. But he's got an extreme bias. You have to be careful. Because he takes a little bit of evidence, and then he extrapolates from that massively beyond what the evidence says. But, you know, we'll talk about it later, but we'll compare different manuscripts, for example, different versions of Luke. And there'll be a word in there, it looks like somebody was trying to improve Luke. In other words, there's something Jesus said in Matthew and something Jesus said in Luke, and they're slightly different. The reason is two different eyewitnesses recording the same thing, slightly different memories of it, okay? And so what a scribe does is they fix it. Yes and no. Yes, in that, does it really change the meaning of the Bible? No. But the fact is, we have older manuscripts and other manuscripts. So there's the Alexandrian manuscripts and the Western manuscripts and all these kind of stuff. And so we're able to make very, very confident statements about what the original was in almost every case. But there are examples, unfortunately, where scribes actually didn't like what it said and changed it. Now, most of these happened 5th, 6th, 7th century. And in almost every case, you can make a clear-cut decision what the original was. I'm going to talk about the rules for that. Now, are there any remaining doubts about certain words? Yeah, there's like, I don't know, a couple dozen words in the entire New Testament where you could probably say there's some, like literally a couple of dozen words in the entire Greek New Testament where you could, you know, maybe say maybe it was there instead of then or something like that. Okay, that's the kind of stuff. Yeah?
Do we know who wrote some of these manuscripts and does it matter?
I don't think any of them, I don't think they have any signed manuscripts. Well, I'm going to talk about that. When I talk about inerrancy, I'm going to keep saying stuff that just to shock you on purpose, just for the sheer fun of shocking you. But by saying what we read is not inspired, for example. Right? The person who translated this, were they inspired? All right. Well, what's that? Whoa, what's that mean? All right. Copyists were not inspired. Oh, what's that mean? And then, but then I'm going to make those statements, luckily in the context where I can explain why they have virtually no effect at all on our ability to have access to the original. In fact, I'll just go throw it up right now. I believe we have so much manuscript evidence, we have so much scholarly knowledge about ancient Greek and Koine Greek, and so much knowledge about the culture that us reading the Bible now can probably have better access to accurate interpretation than most people even living in the second century reading it themselves. In other words, a Greek person reading New Testament in Greek in the second century had no better access to understanding what the writer was saying than we do ourselves. We have so many things that they didn't have. For example, we have knowledge about the Jewish culture of Jesus. You know, so, in the end, I'm going to say that these issues about the reliability of the New Testament evaporate to virtually nothing. But I'm not ready to make that point. I got to, you know, give you some more evidence. Yes?
Is it possible a copyist was inspired?
It's possible, but how would you know? If there's no way to know, then that's useless. Forgive me for calling it useless. I'd call it useless speculation, because how would you know if they were inspired, and how would you know that the one you're looking at is the one that was inspired, and why would God inspire it? I mean, what would be the purpose of it?
Well, the point kind of being, how would you prove yes or no?
But you couldn't. So to speculate it, it's fun, but it's, to be honest with you, of no value or use to speculate other than for fun. Because one thing we know is some of them weren't. So anyway, we'll get back to that. Okay, Codex Bezae. Now that's, let me see, Codex Bezae, that's one of the more important codices. It's from 450. And the reason it's fairly important, even though it's almost 100 years later after Alexandrinus and Sinaiticus, is that there are some significant differences between Bezae and the others. It's called a Western manuscript. And so there's a few passages, significant questions, like what about this, what about that, where Bezae sticks out as being different from Alexandrinus, Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus. So some people have said that those three, Alexandrinus, Sinaiticus, and Vaticanus, those represent, let's say, here's all the different manuscripts that existed. And by a bad luck, we have three that are all from this group over here. So possibly, in some cases, even though Bezae is 100 years later, that possibly some of the readings in Bezae actually represent a closer to the original. Now, this I'm probably giving too much detail for some of us here. I apologize if it's too much detail, but I'm trying to hit all the different levels here and not put Pedro to sleep, because he probably knows a lot of stuff already. All right, so to summarize, these are some of the important manuscripts: John Rylands, Chester Beatty, Bodmer, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, and Bezae, plus 7,942 others. Okay, got it? Now, let me talk a little bit about this: Alexandrine, Western, and Byzantine. So there are three. Now, this is, it's not as clear cut as this. But scholars dive really, really, really deep into this stuff, folks. They spend their whole life looking at all of these ancient manuscripts and trying to see, ferret out where certain changes came into the manuscripts. And what they'll notice, for example, let's say in genetics. All right. So, for example, they can look at your genes, and they can make some guesses as to your ancestry. All right. For example, if you have sickle cell anemia, probably Western Africa. Certain things. So there's a few things, a few changes that happened in the manuscripts. You can estimate, say, probably the first time this came in was probably in Alexandria, probably in the 4th century. And so, therefore, if you have a later manuscript, you can say that's an Alexandrian-type manuscript, because you know, it's just like that's a Western African person because of that particular genetic thing you'd find in there. It's not as clear-cut as that, but it seems like in the West, in other words, in Rome, in Spain, in Carthage, there were certain sort of little tiny things in the New Testament that seem to be found in manuscripts from that part of the world. But the problem is some of these Western manuscripts were found in places like Damascus. So it's all hard to work out. Now, the third kind is called Byzantine. Now, it's going to be in the notes later, I can't remember it. It's either the 7th or 8th century, there was a group of Greek scholars who spoke Greek. They're in Byzantium, which is the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, where they spoke Greek. And they decided to do what we're doing here, which is to try to gather together all the available manuscripts and create a scholarly, accurate Greek text. It's called textual criticism. Got it? And the Jews did that, as we'll see later on, and they created a standard Hebrew text called the Masoretic text. So after this time, most of the Greek manuscripts were taken from the Byzantine. All right. In other words, some really smart people who had great respect for the New Testament, for the Bible, decided to create a standardized Greek text, for example, to remove some spelling errors that come into the text over time or word order things, etc. And this was good and bad, more bad than good for us. It was good for the church back then. It was great for the church back then. It's not so great for us because after that, some of these different things that you could use to sort of figure out what the original was, they stopped making copies of those, and everybody went to using the standard text, which was the Byzantine. All right, so most manuscripts after 1000 AD are of virtually no use whatsoever, even though they're Greek. Most Greek manuscripts after 800 or 900 AD, although they may add to that number 8,000, that number is a little bit padded, I guess you could argue. Okay, got it? Now, we're going to find out that that's the Greek New Testament that a guy named Erasmus uses. Erasmus was a 16th century scholar, the greatest scholar of his age, and he basically put together a Greek text, which includes some things we'll talk about that shouldn't have been in there. And you can't blame Erasmus. He was using the Greek text he had. And all of his texts were the Byzantine type. All of them were. He didn't have any access to the Codex Alexandrinus or Sinaiticus or Vaticanus. All right? So therefore, for example, when people say the King James Version is the only version, it's the authorized version, and if you read anything of the King James, those people, they're crazy. They're crazy. That's crazy. You have to ignore all the data. How could you go with that? Because the King James Version is based only on Byzantine texts. And even if you argue over Codex Bezae versus Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, all that sort of stuff. Forgive me for the information overload for some of you here. Sorry. You can't go with the Byzantine text. You just simply can't do it. Alexandrinus, Sinaiticus, Vaticanus. Those are the principal texts used. All right, and we'll talk about Hort's Greek text of 1895, which has been the standard text. But then, of course, there's been updates to that. All right, anyway, I'll take your question in a second. People will argue that possibly, people have overemphasized those 4th century manuscripts. Possibly. All right, and for example, should look at Bezae a little bit more, and these other ones. Okay, these raise minor issues that probably aren't that important to what we're trying to do in this class. Okay, got it. But definitely, we don't use the Byzantine text. we don't use that. Question. Well, there's a lot of problems with the King James Version. First of all, it's virtually unreadable. That's the problem. Why would you want to read a translation that's virtually unreadable? Doesn't really make any sense. All right. Second of all, it was a good translation in 1611. All right, but we have a much better Greek. By the way, I would say, you know, the Byzantine text, off by 1%, right? Off by 1%. I mean, it's a small difference. And so to go after the King James Version as being bogus, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm saying to say that it's the only reliable and usable and the only it's somehow semi-inspired, that is so not true. And I can prove beyond any doubt. You can't possibly support that position. All right. Nevertheless, the King James, it's not terrible. In fact, it was a fairly good translation. It was very, very scholarly. King James did a really good job putting together a team to make that translation into the English. That's an irrational belief. It's a totally irrational belief. By the way, that's common amongst certain evangelicals, conservative Baptists. By the way, also Mormons.
What's their why?
They don't have an argument. They do not have an argument.
It's the one Paul wrote.
You can't argue with these people. It is literally impossible. Right? They don't have an argument. Now, there are people who defend that who do have an argument, but the people you're talking to don't even talk to those people. All right, let me explain what I mean by that. I'm diving way deep, but I'm only doing it because these two questions came up, okay? People make arguments that the NIV and the NASV and the RSV rely a little bit too much on the 1895 Greek text, which relies heavily on Alexandrinus, Sinaiticus, and Vaticanus. And therefore, they are somewhat biased in what they're doing. But then, fine. So therefore, we go with the Byzantine text. What do you mean? That's not fine at all. It doesn't make any sense at all. Anyway, I have to get some specific examples. All right, and I'm going to go forward here. I can show you some specific examples of why that doesn't make sense. But don't try to argue with these people. Just don't even waste your time. Don't even waste your time. Because anybody who holds to this and would actually defend it, has nothing to do with evidence. I wouldn't go that far. I would just say this is an emotional argument. It's not a logical or rational or evidence-based argument. People just defend that version. But even those who created the King James Version would not defend what these people are defending. Not at all. Anyway. All right. So other evidence to support our New Testaments, the reliability of our text, the Greek text, is we have a number of translations. We have the Coptic, the Old Syriac, the Old Latin. So the New Testament was translated out of Greek into Coptic, Syriac, which is the language in Syria, basically, and Latin, all in the second century. It's a fact. And now, no, we do not have a second century manuscript of the Coptic New Testament. We have, you know, 4th and 5th century and things like that. But what these are, it's like a snapshot. So in other words, a translation is made from a Greek manuscript, right? So it's like a snapshot. All right, so we take a snapshot of Pedro when he's 5 years old. We can look at it now. We can see what he looked like when he was 5 years old. Now we could try to figure out what he looked like when he was 5 years old by looking at him now, right? So that's a manuscript from the 6th century. But what if you have a snapshot? So, for example, let's talk about, Luke 13:11 or something like that, because there's some question about Luke 13:11. What we have is a snapshot of Luke 13:11 in the 2nd century. All right? And even though that's a copy of a copy of a copy of a snapshot from the 2nd century, nevertheless, it's definitely useful evidence. It's quite useful evidence. All right? And again, it allows us to reproduce with fantastic, fantastic reliability what the New Testament looked like in the 2nd century when people who are alive still who knew the writers. You have to understand, in 150 A.D., there were people in the church who knew John. All right? That manuscript from 150 A.D. I showed you, you know, we're really praying for Guillermo's mom, who's very sick, by the way. But I'm thinking she might be close to 90. So that it's 150 AD. So we're talking about she would have been born in 60 AD. All right, got it? So here's a sister in our church, to use the New Testament example, born in 60 AD. And somebody like that could have met John. So could there be any question about who wrote John in 150 AD, given that you had people in the church who knew John? They probably talked to him about when he wrote it. So people try to create this idea that it's, you know, how do you know? And it's very much in doubt. But they forget things like common sense. Common sense. Anyway, so these are further evidence. And now add to that is the church father quotes. Now, it's been said, and I don't know how true it is, but maybe it's a slight exaggeration, I don't know. But it's been said that you could rewrite almost the entire Greek New Testament simply from the quotes of the church fathers in the second and third century. And these, I mean, Origen wrote volumes. Tertullian wrote dozens and dozens, and we have these things. Irenaeus, Justin Martyr. So read my book on church history. It's over there. You can hear about some of these people. But these people quoted extensively. So again, it's like a snapshot. So Polycarp, all right, Ignatius quotes in 108 AD. It's like a snapshot. Do we have a manuscript from 108 AD? Maybe. But what we have is somebody quoting in 108 AD. All right, so let's say somebody's going to change the Bible. All right, first of all, I don't think they did, but if they did, we have quotes from earlier than that. And this helps. So we have Clement of Rome. The book Clement of Rome was written by one of the very first bishops in Rome, Clement, somewhere around 95 or 96 AD. That's first century, folks. And he quotes from 10 of the New Testament books. He quotes from Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians, Hebrews, James, 1 and 2 Peter. All right? And I got a question on this one. These things come into my... just as an example, of typical skeptics here. Okay? How am I doing? Uh-oh, I've got to end in the next 2 or 3 minutes. So this is a person writing to my website. You wrote, all four Gospels are quoted in patristic writings before 100 AD in books such as the Epistle of Barnabas, the Book of Clement of Rome, and the Didache. This person's saying, you don't know what you're talking about. You're making all this up. He says, it's pathetic, he says, that you must base supernatural ideas on false evidences. And then you show this false evidence to the masses. I'd really like to get a response as to where I can find the Gospels mentioned in Clement of Rome. I'm curious to know what words you rummaged through to come up with this ridiculous accusation. Well, let me tell you, folks, what this person did not do is he didn't read the letter of Clement to Rome. He went to a website that says it's not true that Clement of Rome ever quoted from the New Testament. But that's what these people do all the time. Don't you be like this person. Christians behave. Hopefully we don't use profanity. I'm kind of, you know, hopefully we don't use profanity, and hopefully you know that style. But, you know, Christians sometimes behave a little bit like that in dealing with the Quran and other things. So let me just tell you. I don't think it's in my PowerPoint. I don't think it is. All right. So here's 1 Clement chapter 13, verse 1. It's chapter and verse. Let us therefore be lowly-minded, brethren, laying aside all arrogance and conceit and folly and anger. Let us do that which is written, for the Holy Ghost saith, let not the wise boast in his wisdom, nor the strong in his strength, neither the rich in his riches, but he that boasteth, let him boast in the Lord. He's quoting from 1 Corinthians 1:31. And then 1 Clement chapter 12, verse 2. And as pages and pages and pages of quotes of 1 Clement from the New Testament. And so when I said this, I'm not making it up, but I'm telling you, you'll see on the internet, they'll say, no, none of these people ever quoted. You know, they'll say Ignatius did not quote from the New Testament. Polycarp did not quote from the New Testament. Oh, yes, they did. All right, so I'm not making this up, folks. So 95 or 96 AD. So what do we know for a fact in 95 or 96 AD based on Clement's quotes? Two things. What are they? They were written already, and what else? They were scripture. Because Clement, when he quotes, by the way, Clement, he's like, if we could quote the Old Testament like Clement did, it'd be amazing. This guy, he starts talking, and it's just one quote after another. 80% or so from the Old Testament, probably less than 20% from the New Testament. But he quotes the New Testament exactly as he quotes the Old Testament. In other words, we know that there was something somewhat akin to the New Testament in existence, being written and quoted as scripture in the first century. All right? So much for these people.
When was the New Testament canonized?
I'll get to that. You have to come to the class next week. Clement was in Rome, but he was Greek. The church in Rome was in, even though it was a Latin place, well into the second century, the church was a Greek church, even when it was in Roman cities. The first important Roman Latin writer was Tertullian at the end of the second century. I've got all this stuff, but I really need to stop out of respect for your schedules. I can tell nobody actually wants to leave, but that's good, but I better just stop. We barely started on the evidence, folks. We seriously, we've got a lot more to go.